Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Welcome to another edition of the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased that you are all here with me today. We've got another wonderful show. So let's get started with my blog post, as I always do at the beginning of every show. And this one, again, I think rather apropos for what we're going to be talking about today. And this blog post is entitled Not to Be Rushed. We often look for a big experience, the magic pill that will cure us, or the silver bullet that will end our pain. Yet the quick fix never works. Real answers take time, and the fast results never last. Of course, we want our pain and anguish to end as soon as possible. That's only human of us. We've lived with the pain so long, and we are so tired of the agony that we just want it to be over. So it is understandable that we want to find a way to fix it all in an instant. We search for the big experience, hoping it will shock us into peace. Yet the nervous system doesn't work that way. Shocking it only causes more trauma. The real answer is to go slow, to take baby steps, focusing on the immediate, small actions we can take, not big, grandiose gestures that do not last. It can be hard to accept that kind of approach. We are so used to running fast and getting things done that we treat our healing path the same way, like it is something we need to check off a list of things to accomplish. But healing from real trauma takes patience. It takes courage, time, and space. For every time we rush our nervous system, we only cause more energy to get stuck in it, which gives us more to work on when we heal. However, when we decide to take the gentle route, everything changes. Healing is no longer a race to get to an end, but a journey that we go on. Our nervous system starts to unwind and let go of old, stuck energies. We begin to take those small steps that may not seem to lead far in the beginning. Steps lead to great changes. The incremental changes are not obvious at the time. We might even feel that we are not getting anywhere with our trauma. And week after week, month after month, we start to change, forming new habits, making new choices, finding creative ways to deal with difficult situations. It might seem counterintuitive, yet it works. Slow and steady does win the race. So where in your life are you looking for the big experience? How are you rushing your own healing journey? So I wrote this blog post a couple of years ago, I believe after working with some clients who were like, oh, I really want to go deep in my process. I really want to be over and done with this pain and this trauma. And, you know, they were so sincere and they so, you know, just wanted to feel better. And it was a little challenging for me to say to them, I go like, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen in us working together on one session. The body doesn't respond well to being rushed. And it's the slow and steady that really doing our work consistently over a period of time, over and over again, and showing up for ourselves. Like that's how the energies get unlocked. That's how we end up metabolizing these things that have been stored in our bodies for so long. And I know it wasn't what they wanted to hear. And they eventually actually stopped working with me because they really wanted that big experience. You know, they wanted that big breakthrough. And I could have taken them there, but I just knew it wouldn't serve them. And the interesting thing is, like, now knowing what I know, because I've learned so much even in just the last couple of years, and I've taken this healing, this somatic touch form of healing called a transforming touch, which is all about developmental trauma and utero trauma and working with the nervous system. And over again, the teacher is like, going slow, go slow. And I've even heard it said that the body actually moves or operates 70 times slower than the mind. Like insights we can get in an instant. Understandings we can get like that. But to really feel it and embody it, that takes time and effort. And unfortunately, we've all been in pain so long that it's hard to wait until that magic moment. And really, I've come to appreciate how much it is about the journey and not the destination. You know, healing is something we're going to do for the rest of our lives. It doesn't mean we're not going to find a point where we feel better. It doesn't mean that life isn't going to, you know, be better for us as we do our work. But the more we heal, the more we find there are so many tender and soft places in us that need even more healing. So our healing path is not a short destination. It's not a quick run around the bases and making it to home plate in an inning. It's more of a marathon. And the wonderful thing about the marathon is, even though it might take us through some dark valleys, it will also take us to some beautiful vistas and plateaus and mountains and peaks. And it's up and down. It's organic. It's not linear. And because it's not linear, that aha moment, that one thing that tips us over the edge and brings us back to our hearts and brings us to a place where we just feel good to be alive. It could happen at any moment. Nobody knows when it's going to happen for us. But until it does, you know, we just need to keep on the path and keep moving forward, putting one foot in front of the other and doing the best we can as we continue to move forward. And I know for some people listening, just like for the gentleman I was working with a couple of years ago, that might not be what you want to hear today. But it's the truth. And I think that's the most important thing, to really be honest with ourselves and each other about what it truly takes to find our way home. And that's why I do this show. That's why I do the work that I do. And that's why I bring on amazing guests like the two gentlemen who are coming on today. So that's my blog post. Again, it is entitled Healing from Our Trauma is a Slow Process Not to be Rushed. And you can always find my blog on my, did you see it? The brand new Conscious Consultant website, theconsciousconsultant.com. And of course, on the station's website at talkradio.nyc/blog. All right. Now, it is my extreme pleasure to welcome to the show Joe Moore and Kyle Buller, co-founders of Psychedelics Today, one of the world's leading platforms for psychedelic media, education, and thought leadership. Since launching Psychedelics Today in 2015, Joe and Kyle have been at the forefront of shaping informed, responsible conversations around psychedelic medicine, bridging science, spirituality, culture, and personal transformation. Joe brings over two decades of experience spanning psychedelic study, technology, and large-scale project management. A seasoned speaker and podcast host, he's deeply engaged in conversations around drug policy, environmentalism, and ethical use of psychedelics in both medical and personal growth contexts. Kyle's path into this work began with a profound near-death experience at age 16. Oh, I want to know more about that. An initiation that led him into deep exploration of non-ordinary states of consciousness, transpersonal psychology, somatic healing, and breathwork. With a background in clinical mental health counseling and years of experience supporting people in crisis, Kyle brings a grounded, compassionate lens to integrating and healing. Welcome, Joe. Welcome, Kyle, to the Conscious Consultant Hour.
Thanks for having us here.
I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Okay, Kyle, I'm going to start with you just because I've had so many people on my show who've had near-death experiences. I always love to learn just a little bit about it. What happened and what was the experience like that it was so profound for you that it changed your life?
Try to give everybody the short version for time's sake. I got in a really bad snowboarding accident. I was night skiing on New Year's Eve way back when, and went around a turn. There was a mound of snow in a blind spot I didn't see. Hit it, flew through the air, nose of my snowboard hit, shoulder hit, heard a loud pop. I thought I broke a rib. But by the time they got me down to the first aid, I was looking a little pale. My pulse was low. So they said I probably had internal injuries. And thankfully, they ended up getting a medevac and got me out of there quickly. And I just learned maybe like a few years ago, one of the first responders like looked at my dad and said, you know, your son's in his golden hour and he may not make it.
Wow.
So I ended up rupturing my spleen and I lost about 5 to 5.5 pints of blood internally. So by the time I got to the hospital, I could hear the doctors and nurses say, I can't get a pulse on them. And I started to have this experience of like being outside my body, in my body. And they rushed me to get a CAT scan to figure out what was going on. And it was in that moment, I just heard a voice that was kind of guiding me through death, saying, you know, relax into this, you're going home. This is just a transition. And the more that you struggle with it, the harder it's going to be. So the more that you can relax into this experience, the easier the transition will be. And that was a really beautiful experience. I felt like a lot of love and it was like, yeah, a lot of like beauty and bliss. Thankfully they were able to operate quickly and save me. The doctor said if I came in like 5 minutes later, I probably would have been dead on arrival. So really grateful for everybody responding appropriately and quickly that day.
And then after that experience, you were like, there's something more to life. I've got to understand this.
Yeah. I rode a high for a bit of like, you know, thankfully I'm alive. And then kind of came crashing down, I think just, seeing everything. I kind of use this analogy of like, I woke up with like a new map of the world on my chest. And then I'm trying to navigate a new reality that most other people like aren't necessarily aware of or seeing. And, you know, being a young kid too, trying to navigate that without elders or people that like around me that could really understand what I was going through. I think it made it really isolating and lonely. And I think that's what made it come crashing down where I just felt so alone in the process and didn't know how to navigate it. You know, everybody kept saying, well, you should just be thankful you're alive. And yes, I felt that way, but there's like, you know, this psycho spiritual thing unfolding in my life. And you know, I just didn't have the support around me to navigate it. So,
And how long did it take until you felt like you did find some kind of path or guidance that moved you out of that feeling of isolation into something of like, oh, okay, I know how to embody this and live in the world now.
I had a mushroom experience about, I think, 3 years later that really opened me up because it helped me to kind of like relive this near-death experience in a pretty unique way. And that got me curious. And then that started opening up a path to want to study this stuff more like intellectually. And I remember I was at, I did my undergrad in transpersonal psychology and I was taking an eco-psych course and the teacher was just talking about some stuff. And I was like, I had to go up and share my story with them. So I shared everything that was going on from my near-death experience to these really profound psychedelic experiences. And he looked at me and he just said, you know, if you grew up in a traditional culture, the elders would have stepped in and taught you this new way of being in the world and this new way of seeing. But unfortunately, you didn't. And you had to figure it out on your own. And that was like one of the first times I think I felt heard in my experience. And that made me feel really supported. Like, I'm not actually going crazy. Like, there's other cultures. So that was really kind of opening the path up more. I think I was 22 at that time.
Wow, cool, cool. And Joe, I'm assuming your path was not quite as dramatic as that.
Yeah, definitely a little bit more calm. I'll try to figure out the compressed way to get you here up to 2026. So, interning in software since 16, started a computer science degree, touched a philosophy 101 class in my freshman year. There was a reference to Stan Grof's LSD psychotherapy and assigned reading called Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot. It was a pretty dramatic scene that looked like an exorcist thing. Yeah. Or poltergeist, and I'm like, oh, this is wild. College is supposed to teach me truthful things, right? So if this is true, I want to know. I kind of want to call bullshit, but I want to do some good work here. So I went to the library, small state school in New Hampshire, Plymouth State, and we had three or four books by Stan Grof in the library, which is extraordinary. And I was off to the races as a very underprepared freshman reading Grof, not knowing what the hell was going on, and was really trying. Nobody could speak to me about it, so I found some internet groups and found a mentor in Vermont. Kyle and I got connected through the folks at Dream Shadow, Lenny and Elizabeth Gibson, and that was some kind of holotropic mentorship, we'll call it, outside of my philosophy training. I bailed on computer science and took up philosophy pretty aggressively, and you know, kept working in software. Just turns out you don't need a degree. and then, that was kind of getting me started. I started doing a lot of holotropic breath work, started after college coordinating a lot of community in Boston around ayahuasca and psychedelics and getting people to actually kind of build community, because I saw a handful of people going pretty far, but having nowhere to land. And so I was doing that under the aegis of Evolver, which was partnered with Reality Sandwich way back. It's a whole different thing now.
Right.
Jonathan Talat Phillips and a bunch of others. Yeah. And that was fun. I hosted an ayahuasca monologues event with Adam Ellenboss and Jonathan Talat Phillips in Cambridge, Mass, at this gorgeous theater, which is a really fun kind of capstone to my time in Boston. Left for Colorado, tried to do the same thing in Boulder. It was too crowded. Couldn't hang in Denver. Moved up to the mountains, met Kyle shortly after, and we started getting really active on the internet with Psychedelics Today after a bit of time. Kyle was trying to talk me into going to his grad program he was building out at Burlington College, and I was trying to talk him out of going to college or getting a graduate degree, because I still have a hard time with the value of graduate degrees. But, you know, that's how we got here. Yeah, and so, I've had some big experiences, but everything was kind of done kind of the reverse. I did a lot of holotropic breath work, then I did some ayahuasca, then some mushrooms, but then it turned into a recreational thing where I was doing a lot of fish concerts and jam bands in Denver and all that kind of stuff. So it was like do the healing and then do the celebration maybe. But, you know, I was definitely doing too much for a bit.
Yeah. As I think many people who discover psychedelics, you know, kind of like dive into it and like, wow, this is amazing. And you do a little too much. And you're like, oh no, I need some time. Just out of curiosity, where did the idea for creating Psychedelics Today, like what was the inspiration? What was the spark that got you two to say, oh, let's do this thing together?
Kyle and I were chatting and we're like, we want to do something together. What is it? I had already had a few podcasts in different arenas and in 2016, right? So we're coming up on 10 years old. We're like, let's just start recording our teacher because he's getting older and he's got so much great stuff to say. Lenny Gibson is, you can't even start to like talk about his body of work like in a skillful way. But the integration of philosophy, psychology, extraordinary experience was just very helpful and we wanted to capture that. Mm-hmm. And so there was that. And then there is this thing around a lot of the conferences had some of the same voices getting mm-hmm. platformed all the time. And we're like, we know there's other interesting people out here. Let's start bringing that forward. Mm-hmm. And then Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong, I think the third part was trying to get transpersonal psychology to be more forward in mm-hmm. the environment.
Yeah. Yeah. Bringing like transpersonal psychology, breath work forward into like the psychedelic arena. And something that we were saying that was kind of like a little phrase we would hear a lot of times, like the real conversations and the real meat at conferences are the conversations out in the hallway. Right. And it's like we kind of wanted to, you know, create those hallway conversations.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Beautiful. Beautiful. All right. So we're going to take our first break. When we come back, let's talk about like, what is the mission of psychedelics today? You know, how do you serve people and what is the need that you see that you're filling for people today? Okay. All right. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We do this every week. This week is special on Thursday. We're moving to Wednesdays next week. So from now on, it'll be on Wednesdays at 12 noon Eastern time. And we're talking this hour with Joe Moore and Kyle Buller, co-founders of Psychedelics Today. And we'll be right back in just a moment.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
And welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. So, Joe, what would you say is the mission for psychedelics today?
I used to have this memorized, but we're really trying to bring forward this new vision of what does a psychedelically literate and activated humanity look like, mm-hmm. and what is that allow us to do and to become. And mm-hmm. so I think we're not just looking at psychotherapy and healing. We're looking at creating new potentials, like creative problem solving, new ways of being, things along those lines. Kyle, did I kind of capture that well enough?
I think so. Yeah. I forget our original mission statement around like human potential and trying to like also help to normalize exceptional experience in our culture. Because I think like when the culture starts to normalize these experiences, then we can really think about integration as well, right? Instead of like, oh, these are experiences aren't real, or oh, that experience is, you know, quote unquote crazy, right? It's like, how do we help to normalize these experiences and understand that it's within the range of like the human experience?
We had a friend, Sam, working at a clinical trial for psilocybin, and kind of had a number of endogenous mystical experiences that were kind of knock your socks off kind of experiences, no drugs, right? Mm-hmm. And a major problem in our space is this. One of the leads, a psychiatrist, psychologist working on the trial, tried to biologicalize it and minimize the experience to like, you know, that can just happen. And like, it doesn't mean anything. And it's like that, to me, is a fundamental thing that we need to get over. It's like people have experiences and they mean something, yeah, or not, but like they mean something to the person, to the organism that had the experience. Right. And like to just sweep that under the rug because of science, it's not fair. It's not okay. And we need to fix that.
Yeah, it's kind of like in the past, in ancient times, like science and spirituality were together. They were like one study. And then during the Renaissance and Industrial Revolution, it kind of split apart. And now it's sort of sounds like you're trying to bring it back together. So, Kyle, what is it that psychedelics today actually offers for people?
Yeah, we offer our media, which is like the podcast and blogs and articles and newsletters. And then I would say like a main focus of our thing is in education. So we offer a lot of educational programs from, you know, free little things that people can get into and like just kind of dipping their toes in to shorter, like maybe 9-8 week courses to then we have a full length year long program. Really trying to, yeah, as I like to say, like help people develop psychedelic literacy and competency so that they can go back into the world and be of service, whether, you know, you're a clinician, a therapist, and you have clients that you're working with that are talking about psychedelics, or maybe you're going out and wanting to be an advocate or an educator, community leader, but having a good foundation for really kind of understanding, the science, the spiritual aspects of psychedelics and all that stuff. So really helping people to develop those literacy and the competencies.
One of the things that I've seen from going to the Horizons conference that happens here in New York, I've been there several years. I went to the Psychedelic Sciences, not the most recent one, but the one before. Is while there are some people talking about sort of the spiritual aspect of working with psychedelics, so much of it was around the medical, right? It was healing trauma, PTSD, OCD, like all these diagnoses. And it almost feels like, at least in the general efforts that are being made to legalize it, it's all just about medical. And it feels like it's lost its connection to the spiritual side of psychedelics, which it sounds like the two of you are trying to bring back together. Why do you think that split is happening? And do you think that we can really bring it back together?
Such a complicated question. I almost hate to use the term spirituality. It's, you know, it's a more integral view of reality, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why, you know, integrative or holistic or things like those kind of whatever, you know, spiritual practice is a thing. Anyway, this kind of stuff happened with the mind-body split, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the French Enlightenment, René Descartes, Isaac Newton, like, you know, things are not as precise and mathematical in reality as we have been trained to believe they are. You know, they're a lot more gooey and fluid. And, you know, this is why I'm really excited about philosophy and the intersection of philosophy with psychology, because we can actually kind of become more nuanced with our understanding of reality. And scientists have been trained, you know, with calculus and statistics, and, you know, the world is calculus and statistics when it really isn't. Like, calculus kind of like implies a really smooth curve through nature, and it's really like more jumpy. you know, there's little gaps between things. And
indeed, like the scientists who are exploring quantum mechanics and quantum physics, there's actually so much that they're finding that's in alignment with what ancient mystics have been saying for millennia.
Yeah. Yeah. So Fritjof Capra and his work kind of kicked that off ages ago. Irvin Laszlo, I have not read his work yet, but he's kind of holding that mantle. And we're seeing kind of ions like Dean Radin and other kind of similar projects come forward now. Like, I think 2026 is the year of consciousness. You'll quote me on that later. Ooh, but I think we're going to see a lot of movement. Michael Pollan's book's coming out. Mm-hmm. I think UC Berkeley is going to have a conference on consciousness. So scientists and researchers and, you know, people who are helping inform how we can do better new science are going to have to be informed by kind of quantum worldviews, process philosophy style worldviews, where things aren't just kind of XY grids and statistical plots. There are really important data on the far edges that come forward in research that we should be digging more into. Yeah. You know, why did that person have such a strong reaction in the psilocybin clinical trial to Benadryl, for instance? Why did that look so much like a psilocybin mystical experience? And they actually had Benadryl? Like, that kind of stuff's bonkers. You know, we want to call that placebo, but that's like a really strong effect, really strong effect from Benadryl, or sorry, diphenhydramine. And we need to restructure how we're doing studies. Mm-hmm. And these need to be like really rigorously looked at. So we should be talking to folks like Rupert Sheldrake and others who have been at this for ages to say, how do we want to inform science now? And like, perhaps where is money best spent on science? Because we can keep replicating studies, which we should, but also we should keep trying to expand what our paradigm is.
Yeah. I heard a while ago that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies had to abandon the idea of testing their drugs against placebos because the placebo effect became like more than 20% effective. So it wasn't good. So then they just started testing like the newer drug against an older drug.
You mean in psychedelics?
No, in regular psychopharmacology.
I think there was an article that just came out. One of our students just sent it over to me about this problem in psychedelics too, where actually somebody was getting some healing benefit from a placebo, and it like has kind of thrown stuff off. But, you know, also looking at like a study like psychedelics, it's like, you know, my critique is, you know, when does somebody get like 6 hours of focus attention on you? You know, like that's a big deal for somebody that may never have had therapy or like a supportive container to then have all this like attention on you. You know, of course, somebody's probably going to feel a little bit better to some degree. So it's like, how do you root out those variables? But, you know, I think to your point also, like, how do we get to the medicalization, right? Like these drugs were illegal too. And so I think Rick Doblin was really the one that started to like, you know, look at like, how do we bring this back, and trying to bring MDMA through the FDA process and through that. And so, you know, that becomes more of this medical paradigm when we're looking at drugs from this perspective. And, you know, our teacher, we actually wrote a book chapter on this about like the medicalization and like what happens if, you know, the movement took more of a spiritual or religious approach. It probably wouldn't have passed through, even though like here in the States, we do have like religious freedom. But there's something I think a little bit more rigorous about the medicalization, and that's helping to counter the taboo and stigmatization that, you know, we've been experiencing for decades around these substances. So,
I mean, how do you take sort of this, the new understanding of physics and of reality, whatever kind of spiritual belief systems, but how do we bring that into working with psychedelics in a grounded way that it actually supports people in their process?
Medicine and science are super different. And we have to start there. So science can inform how medicine is practiced and helps add new tools to the doctor's toolkit. Right. So like, people look at the MAPS clinical trials and think that's medicine. It's like, that's, you know, very much not medicine. It's very much research. And it's super different from how any physician would want to practice,
right?
You know, like on their own. So I think, Sam, understanding the philosophy of science, like, I think we need to just spend time. Like, let's actually do a couple years, heavy duty philosophy of science, and kind of all of us kind of get on a different page about what work needs to be, how we need to reframe what we're looking at. You know, I don't know if you've heard like kind of this new stuff on like microtubules and, you know, how those, check out the second season of Telepathy Tapes from Your Home City of New York. It's really good. And there's some interesting stuff in there, but check out microtubules later as like a mediator of consciousness. It's an interesting concept. And it's, I don't have it well enough dialed to explain it, but so, you know, what do we know? What do we not know? What are the limits to the scientific process? And we need to just own that. Like, it's okay that there's limits to this method, given how bonkers the world is. Right. And, you know, to bring Terence McKenna in, as if monkeys with sharp teeth have a chance at understanding reality to the level we kind of are pretending to.
Yeah.
You know, so we have a lot of work to do on a fundamental level. And right. Yeah, we can keep doing research and keep making some progress here and there, but I think we need to start asking some really, and I'm not asking any particular scientist to stop their work.
Right.
I just like, let's actually step back and get slightly meta about the work we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that can inform how medicine is practiced. Not, I'm not the clinician in the room, but like from a doctor's perspective, it's like, are we, doctors are in a hard spot. Clinicians are in a hard spot. Insurance drives in America how medicine is done. It's not about optimal outcomes ever.
Yeah. Kyle, while like the legalization is in process and we've got, you know, Colorado, Oregon, I think New Mexico now has legalized psilocybin, there's still a huge underground movement, right? I think probably the majority of people, or, you know, upwards of 70-80% of people there, their introduction to psychedelics is working with an underground facilitator. What can we do to help the, I don't know, mainstream or just people who don't have any experience with this, help them to take sort of the underground movement a little more seriously?
Yeah, right, because I think there's like a stigma there too, right? And it's like, if we look at like where did a lot of our protocols come from, of like a lot of it also came from the underground, came from a lot of also indigenous perspectives, right? And you know, it also I think helps to provide some more access. And I kind of see it as like, you know, you're talking about these like states that legalized. I like to see a really diverse like playing field, like an ecosystem, right? Like the legal model is going to be really important for some people, like folks that have like fear of like, you know, having something legal and like having a regulated framework provides a little bit of trust for somebody. Mm-hmm. A lot of people aren't going to go into the underground because trying to find providers is really difficult. You know, a lot of people just kind of lay under the radar. They're not always advertising. I mean, I don't know. Nowadays people are advertising like crazy for certain things. I'm like, huh, I mean, how are you guys getting away with some of this stuff?
Yeah.
you know, people have higher risk tolerances, but you know, sometimes like for some people, the trust just isn't there. They'd rather go to a clinic, they'd rather go to like a hospital setting. Maybe they do want to participate in research because they feel safer in that way. But there's so many folks that have been in the underground for decades that have been doing really, really wonderful work. And, you know, again, like some of those practices have really informed like protocols throughout the years and whatnot. So, but again, it's tricky. You are, like a lot of people are also putting themselves a bit at risk by doing that, right? Like thinking about like, what state are you in? Is it illegal? You know, Joe and I are both here in Colorado where the rules and regulations have really loosened over the past few years. But, you know, that's not going to be accessible for everybody. Right. And it does take a little bit of a higher risk tolerance to engage in the underground because of breaking the law. And that's something that we have to remember. You know, these are still Schedule I substances. Even for, you know, where it is legal or decriminalized, it's still like federally Schedule I. Yeah. And so I think everybody is that's involved in this space is a bit of a risk taker in some way, shape or form. And I think it really just all comes down to risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm. Joe, I'm curious, when people come to your website, to Psychedelics Today, and they're looking for information, what do you feel like most people, I know it's probably too generalized a question, but what do you think most people are looking for? What kind of education are they looking to get?
Let's see. I don't have a great answer for you, Sam. So people could be coming from all walks of life, right? So anywhere from a psychiatrist with like a fully endowed professorship to like somebody whose son took mushrooms yesterday and they found out. Mm. Like it's such a huge range of people that Psychedelics Today serves. We have content that's being used in universities. We have content that's informing likely legal cases, you know, or like how 750 something episodes and a whole bunch of blogs and articles and, you know, free classes and all sorts of stuff like that. So we have greatly informed the world about these materials, substances, and who we want to serve everybody, but that's kind of it's a great way to do a mediocre job. So what we're trying to do more so is people with a professional interest in the space. Let's try to get them onboarded and to become professionals in the space in whatever capacity that is. So we want them to have a really broad understanding of psychedelics and substances more generally. We want to have them really spun up on the drug war and why we need to end it and why it's actually killing people in a not great way. Yeah. And that we can do a lot better around psychedelic policy, drug policy, and as a collective. So that's kind of what we're aiming towards with our Vital program too. How do we have like the next generation of holistic, highly informed, drug agnostic, potentially technique agnostic facilitators?
Mm-hmm. Nice. So it's almost like, although everybody from the layperson who just wants to understand it to the professional who wants to maybe integrate it into their practice, you're serving everyone, but you're more leaning in the direction of working with the professionals because they're the ones who are going to help bring access to all these people who are looking for it more.
Correct. And when I say professionals, I want to be a little bit more broad than facilitators. It's not just that. It's like the accountants, the designers, Kyle.
Yeah, just as you're saying, like professionals can be a lot of different things. Folks like switching careers, they want to like, you know, integrate this into their life in a professional way, right? So Yeah, we did like an analysis a while ago. We did have like three categories, but again, it's pretty general. It's like the psychedelic curious, the psychedelic professional, and then you had like the psychonauts that are just deeply, deeply enmeshed in this world for quite a while.
Yeah, I remember one of the things I thought was so funny was when I was at Psychedelic Sciences and there was one session, I forget what it was about, but like people were asking questions about how to get involved in the industry and they were like, well, you know, if you design a website, if you do branding, you could do it for someone who works with this stuff. You know, like there's all the ancillary things that just like any business or any individual offering something that they need all kinds of services that you don't have to be the person who's serving the sacrament or the substance to the person. Okay, let's take our last break. And then when we come back, let's talk about what are the needs you see today and how are you looking to fill those needs around the psychedelic industry. And also, I wanted to know, I meant to ask you before about domestic versus international. Like, how much is it just, are you focused just on the United States versus the world at large? Okay. So everyone, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, and we'll be right back with our guests, Joe Moore and Kyle Buller of Psychedelics Today, in just a moment.
On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Okay, gentlemen. So I'll pitch this out to either one of you. What do you see as the needs today? What do people need to know around this whole topic to make a better informed decision about whether it's right for them and whether this is something they should engage in?
That's a good question. Yeah, and so nuanced, right? So individual. You know, I think a lot of people are reading headlines and really wanting to dive in because, you know, I think pointing to your blog earlier, I think it's, you know, you bring up like a really important point about like, you know, people just want this magic bullet, this pill. They want healing quick and fast, and psychedelics have kind of been portrayed that way. And that's not always the case, right? Like, I think taking it slow and thinking if it is right for you, right? Sometimes psychedelics can be really destabilizing for some folks. And there's something I always say that I learned from some of my colleagues, Ido Cohen and Deanna Rogers, like, are you ready to shake the ground that you're on? And maybe if you aren't in the place to shake the ground, you don't feel like you don't have a good foundation to do that. Like, maybe it's not time to do it. But there's so much out there now, right? Like, access to these medicines and drugs seem to, I mean, you know, you can look at Instagram, you know, you have these folks selling stuff. You go to head shops that are selling weird chocolate bars with random chemicals in it, right? So there's a lot of like information that people should know about. Like, just because people are like selling this on the sidewalk, which, you know, we say sometimes people selling like mushroom bars, it's like, that might not necessarily be psilocybin, right? You might actually be taking another compound there. And then around like dosing, right? Like, Joe and I just went to a psychedelic cup down in Denver a couple months ago, and they had all the testing there. And I mean, it was wild to think about like, oh, I'm going to take a gram of mushrooms and thinking like that's equal across the board. There was one mushroom, I forget what the ratio was. It was like up to like 35 milligrams per gram. And thinking about like clinical trials, they usually do 25 milligrams of psilocybin. And so 1 gram of mushrooms has more than, you know, than the dose in these clinical trials where they are doing these high doses. And so there's a lot of like kind of nuanced stuff around that of like just trying to understand the landscape. Like, you know, I think a question that we get often is like, what drugs should we take, right? Is it MDMA? Is it mushrooms? Is it ayahuasca? Is it this? You know, I've been seeing all this stuff. I don't know where to start. Again, and I think that's going to come down to somebody's individual decision around like, is this right for me? And there's lots of other really great practices and techniques to dive into beforehand. you know, find a therapist to work with, find somebody that does somatic work. Joe and I are obviously biased towards breath work as a really great way to dip your toes in first, to build some somatic resiliency and somatic practices before taking the deep dive. So yeah, I don't know. There's definitely a lot there, and it does get really nuanced depending on like how people are trying to approach this stuff, right?
Yeah. And Joe, I wanted to ask you, you know, we brought up a couple of times indigenous cultures, and I've had people on my show talk about honoring the indigenous cultures. And there definitely, I feel, can be a lot more that we can do to truly honor these tribes who've kept these traditions alive through generations of persecution. But I hear all too often people deciding to go down to some retreat center in Peru or Costa Rica and doing like four nights of ayahuasca right off the bat, and they've never even smoked pot. And that's not always the safest thing to do. And I'm just wondering, when people hear this and they're thinking, oh yeah, I want to do something big like that, like what can we do to inform people about how to make a safer, healthier choice for themselves?
I encourage people to go a little bit slower than they are feeling, like generally speaking. You know, oh sure, you want to do that? Amazing. Why do you want to do that? And you know, that process of asking a series of whys, five whys, to get to like the bigger truth behind it all.
Right.
They might just have some sort of short circuit in their logic helping them kind of say, oh yeah, five nights in a row is totally what I need. and that might not be true. I think having appropriate historical context is really helpful. So if we look at ayahuasca, traditionally, historically, from the best of our knowledge, Westerners and their tourist dollars have transformed how ayahuasca shamanism looks to the Western consumer. It used to, in my understanding, it used to be the case that the ayahuascaero was the one consuming the medicine and doing the magic and healing, and it wasn't necessarily the customer, the client, the tourist doing, you know, consuming ayahuasca. So I think we're desperate and we want healing and we hurt so bad, so we're going to do that thing. And that's a real, you know, how do we, when somebody's kind of in crisis, how do we then say, oh, wait a second, read these four books?
Yeah.
You know, like, this is hard. And this is a cultural problem that we all need to collectively look at, is how do we create more realistic storytelling other than, you know, I was at a distasteful example. Like, yeah, Richard Branson was hosting some ayahuasca thing at Branson's Islands. And, you know, it was really cool to be doing ayahuasca next to these really rich people. And I'm like, what? Like, you know, you'll hear these stories sometimes and like, that's not the point.
Yeah.
And what is the point? And I think I don't want to tell people what the point is, but I want people to have appropriate context for who they are when they go into different environments. And, you know, what do tourist dollars do when you bring them into those zones? I'm not saying don't do it either. Right. I have a chip on my shoulder about how often people fly to Peru to do medicine. Yeah. It's like, hey guys, what about the planet? you know, it cool that you can afford all that jet fuel, but isn't there a more scalable, more ecologically appropriate way to do this?
Yeah.
Sam, you bring up being respectful of indigenous cultures, and I think that's part of it. You know, trying to do your best to understand what they're doing now and why and where they came from and what they were doing before.
Yeah. And also some things that are acceptable in indigenous cultures, because it's a different culture, different environment, are not necessarily what we would deem acceptable here. And to me, it kind of also highlights like there's a difference in sort of the Western mindset versus the Eastern mindset versus indigenous mindset, that there are different ways we approach things. And sometimes we go to the thing that's most exotic and different for us without even honoring sort of our own traditions. And it kind of always brings to mind the, the whole idea that, like, in sort of this very Western Judeo-Christian mindset, that there's this idea that we need to suffer for our enlightenment. Like in order to, we have to suffer first in order to purify our soul or something. And with psychedelics, there's actually many people sort of take that approach and go for that high dose, and they're suffering through their first experience. But as you say, if we slow down, right, Joe, if we slow down, take it easy, go titrate, you know, and find our balance, we don't have to suffer for our healing, do we? That we can actually find a way to do it in a more gentle process that more serves our nervous system to help us metabolize and unwind some of these things we've been holding for so long without having to shock ourselves, like I talked about in my blog.
There's a lot there.
Sorry.
Yeah. Why put in more trauma if you're trying to get rid of trauma, if that's your game? I don't know what game everybody's playing, right? And I like this metaphor, Sam, of sometimes, back rewinding the tape. Often people in psychology, post Carl Jung included, use a lot of alchemical metaphor. And there's this kind of phase when the material is getting burnt or cooked. And what if we put it on low for years? As opposed to medium heat or even low heat, like let's put it on like warm and like have that process go and go and go. And it's not that it's not going to be difficult or scary. It's that you just might not be setting yourself up for more pain that, you know, is not as necessary.
Yeah. I love that.
Like, you can always get more pain if you want it. It's on the
pull
menu.
Pull out mom's old slow cooker instead of like putting the big pot on the range with a high flame.
Mm-hmm.
I was definitely like the person, I think I jumped in the deep end pretty quick with like the near death experience and then some of these like really profound psychedelic experiences. And it was like, I think I was actually, the work I've been doing is like trying to heal from like the trauma that came up in those experiences. And, you know, I think before I always had that like idea that, you know, if I'm not dying and I'm not having like this ego death, I'm not doing it right. Right. It's like it always, and my position has really changed, kind of like what we're talking about. It's like a more slower titrated process. Like, can we actually hold the experience in our nervous system? And when are we going outside our window of tolerance? And I feel like a lot of people actually probably go outside their window of tolerance because they do too much. And instead, it's like, why are we always looking for these really big experiences? And it might be a cultural thing, right? It's like, we're looking for something big, fast, quick versus like taking the time to like, you know, sitting on the warming pot a bit, letting that alchemical stew like actually come together. But we don't live in that culture where maybe we feel like we have the time to do that, right?
Right. Like if it took us 20, 30, 40, 50 years to get where we are today, what if it takes another 10 years for us to heal? I mean, compared to how long we've lived, you know, it's still quote unquote fast. All right, gentlemen, I literally could talk to you guys all day about this stuff. We've got to start wrapping it up. So one last word of advice for our listeners, you know, a little nugget that can serve them if they're curious or even if they're already engaged in using psychedelics. What would you say to them, Kyle?
The first thing that just popped in my head, and I think it got sparked by your blog post, become curious about your own process. There's a quote by Arnold Mandel where he talks about becoming fascinated about your own process, not in like an egotistical kind of way, but like, you know, even like when, you know, the difficulty arises, how do we become curious about that? And so just really bringing curiosity to the forefront. How do we stay curious, keep asking questions? Because we don't know where it's going to lead to. And I think if psychedelics, I don't know, in my experience, it promotes a lot more curiosity, not always having the answers. So how do we keep, you know, becoming curious about our own process here and continuing to ask questions?
Cool. Joe, how about you? What do you have?
Oh, keep learning, keep expanding the boundaries. I think this isn't just psychotherapy or spirituality. We're also looking at Spinal cord injuries and chronic pain conditions. Check out the Psychedelics and Pain Association for more there. It's a nonprofit I work with. And there's just so much room left for us to expand this. And it, the most complicated thing we know about, I think, in the universe is the human brain. Mm-hmm. And psychedelics are just an adjunct to that.
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. Joe, if people want to learn more, where do they go? How do they get in touch with you?
Yeah, psychedelicstoday.com. We're all over socials, and we would love to follow up. info@psychedelicstoday.com if you have questions.
Wonderful. Wonderful. All right. Kyle, Joe, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to come on my show today. A real pleasure having you.
Appreciate it.
All right. And of course, thank you, my loyal listeners, for tuning in each week. Without you, there is no show. And don't forget, if you did miss any part of today's show, you can always catch the replay on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and talkradio.nyc. Thank you so much. Take care, everyone. We will talk to you all next week.
Love it.
Educate, empower. On Frank About Health, we're not just talking healthcare. We're managing disruption and innovation. Over the last 4 years, I've taken you from epilepsy and COVID to mental health, caregiving, and now the front lines of healthcare transformation. Stay tuned for a healthier future as we bring on the innovators, professionals, storytellers, and advocates who show you how to own your healthcare every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your Conscious Consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.